You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin native who's blended his passion for motorcycles and yoga into a yoga class he teaches just for bikers. Now, eventually the COVID-19 pandemic is going to come to an end, but that's not to say the virus will be eliminated completely. Health experts say it'll likely fade into the background like other pathogens as enough people gain immunity through infection or vaccination. At that point, COVID will become endemic. Basically, that means the virus will still be here, but we'll be able to go about our normal lives. Earlier this year, it looked like we were headed there sooner than later. Then the Delta variant showed up and infections began rising again. Now, mask mandates are coming back and schools are changing their reopening plans. So how do we get to endemic status? Our next guest says it won't just be a medical effort, but a psychological one as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How much risk are you willing to tolerate in coexisting with COVID? Do you have trouble making decisions about what is risky, what is safe? If so, you're not alone. Do you think we reopened too fast? Not fast enough? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julie Downs is an associate professor of psychology and decision science and director of the Center for Risk Perception and Communication at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Julie, I think for a lot of us, it's been kind of a roller coaster. Vaccines came out, yay. COVID numbers went down, yay again. Delta, boo, numbers going back up. Does that just make it really hard for individuals to evaluate risk and what we're supposed to be doing from day to day?
Yeah, this has been a really hard situation, I think, for people to get their hands around. You know, it takes us a long time to figure out how to act in different risky situations. And when it's changing underneath us, then just when we have it figured out, we sort of have to go back to ground zero and figure it all out all over again.
Does it make it harder for us to cope with that sort of a roller coaster ride we've been happening when we keep seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, then we get into another tunnel?
Yeah, it really does. And people sort of, you know, when it was brand new, it was scary to everybody. And people kind of figured out how to deal with it and develop strategies. And then, of course, the science sort of changes under us and it looks like it's getting better and better. And we get more used to it, so we get a little less scared of it. Then when things change and it gets more dangerous, just as we're getting used to it and the technology, they've kind of two reactions. One is that people get fatigue with trying to deal with it, or they get scared all over again. But the other thing that people sort of say, I'm just tired of, you know, maybe they think it was overblown, maybe they feel, and now it seems so familiar that they're less scared of it than they were at the beginning. And so you have people dealing with it in such a range of different levels of reaction that sometimes you have difficulty understanding that somebody else is having. Somebody else might go out and meet a friend at a bar and sit there drinking with no mask, and then you have a friend in the other direction who hasn't left the house in 15 months. And, you know, it's sort of hard to understand why different people have different reactions to it.
This isn't the sort of crisis that's going to end, you know, like flipping a light switch. This is going to be a slow fade, I think. How do you suggest people think about the decisions of when we start to acting like this is just normal life? We know this virus is still out there, but we're vaccinated. When do you see us starting to behave like this is just a normal background event?
Yeah, I mean, I really look to the CDC guidance for, you know, what they tell me to do, I pretty much comply because they're really experts in knowing what the appropriate, precautions to take and things like that. I think in terms of our psychological feeling of risk, that's something that's going to take time and it's going to take different people different amounts of time. I think for everybody, we should wait until the CDC tells us, yes, it's safe to go to a restaurant, have no masks. The numbers are low enough that you don't have to worry about it. At that point, we definitely need to be listening to the experts and following the guidance, because it's still much riskier than, you know, the vast majority of other things that we come into contact with in our daily lives. But there will come a point when the CDC says, you know, enough people are vaccinated and the numbers are low And it's okay now, even though people are still getting COVID, it's okay to have schools, have kids without masks, have go to the theater again, go to some live music, go to a restaurant, a crowded restaurant, and that will be okay. And at that point, some people will just embrace that and be thrilled. Some people are already trying to embrace that too soon. But there are some people who are going to still feel nervous about it because it's been such a defining characteristic for so long. And I think for the people who are feeling more nervous, they're going to have to take baby steps and try it out and go to a restaurant, you know, at that point and go to places and sort of see how they feel to get their perception of risk down to the point where they feel comfortable doing that. And some people might take precautions for a lot longer than all the people around them think is okay. And I think then for the rest of us who don't feel that extreme level of care is warranted, to be tolerant and say, you know, if it takes you an extra few months or a year to the point where you feel safe going out, you know, that's not hurting me. And I can be tolerant of that and not, you know, if you want to wear a mask when you are sitting in my classroom and I'm teaching, I'm certainly not going to say, hey, take off your mask. You know, if you need that to feel comfortable, that's just fine. And so I think we'll see a lot of variability in people getting to that feeling comfortable.
Talking to Julie Downs, Associate Professor of Psychology and Decision Science at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, looking at the psychology of COVID risks and our behavior when we think we'll be back to normal. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. Maybe with the tell us how you have weighed one risky option versus something else to try to decide what was right for you and your family. Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Columbus. Chris, hello.
All right, great topic as usual. Yeah, so I have a very good perspective on this. I've been traveling around the country as a travel nurse treating COVID patients. You know, in 10 years of nursing, I only had 2 patients pass on me with COVID. I've had a dozen. It's real. It's dangerous, but it's not dangerous for the general public. I've had 2 patients in 2 years under the age of 50 that were hospitalized with COVID. If you don't have heart disease and diabetes and you're not overweight and you're not over 70, it's very low risk. The other thing is we need to implore upon the CDC to actually study herd immunity from natural immunity and the titer levels of vaccinated people. These are things they're not doing, but it's commonly accepted medical practice for every other virus that you get a vaccine for. And we just don't know what the herd immunity is because they're not testing who's got antibodies.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Julie, what do you think, first of all, of Chris's assessment of the risk, especially now that Delta is here? And I'm seeing, at least in other states, higher numbers of younger people ending up in hospitals.
Yeah, and I think one of a really good points that this caller is making is that the science is really in flux and in 2 ways. One is that we are learning in real time things that have been true all along, but it takes of very low data and figure it out. And the other is that, of course, the virus is mutating. So not only is our education behind, you know, the curve, but then it changes and then we have to learn how it's different from how it has been. And I think it's a really interesting point, this question of trying to figure out the titer levels of people, you know, people who have been vaccinated versus people who might have some level of natural immunity having been infected. Both of them, you know, physiological processes are going to help to increase herd immunity. My understanding, and I want to stress that I'm a psychologist, not an epidemiologist, but my understanding from what I've read is that the natural immunity is not as strong as the vaccine provided immunity and maybe not as long lasting. And we're seeing now that, you know, both of them fade over time to the point that even vaccinated people are going to be recommended to get a booster shot. So we're learning all of this in real time. And I do think it's being studied, but it's just an enormous effort to collect these kinds of data. So I think that's an important point. And of course, one thing I have heard people say is that when you have some of these two-shot vaccines, that the first shot sort of triggers the immune response, you know, to have some sort of response. And then the second shot gets a different sort of qualitatively different kind of immune response. That if somebody has had the infection in the past, this is a very loose analogy, but that might be loosely analogous to having had a first shot, but not a second shot. So somebody like that might want to get that booster, just even though they've been infected in the past, we know that they're not as protected as someone who's been vaccinated. And so they might want to think about the vaccine in terms of a booster shot to make sure that they're protected. I think the other point about it certainly seemed to be true early on that older people were by far in a way the ones that were hospitalized, the ones that were dying of COVID. And so you might wonder what you should do if you're someone who's, you know, in very good health and in your 30s, 40s, 20s, and, you know, maybe you don't feel that you're at as high risk. And so there's two points I think are really important to make. One is that with the Delta variant, that may be changing. We're still studying it because it could just be that vaccination levels are different at different ages, but we certainly are seeing more young people in the hospital that, you know, proportionally than we saw before. So it could be that this Delta variant is riskier for younger people. But the other really important point I think we all have to understand is that if you're a 20-something and you don't think that you're going to get terribly sick, that may be true relatively compared to an older person, but you can spread it. You can spread it further. You could catch it, be asymptomatic, but infect your grandparent, infect your neighbor. And I can tell you, I won't relay the stories, but I've heard stories of this happening and the guilt that people feel when they infect their friends or neighbors or grandparents or parents because they weren't concerned for themselves. And I've heard stories of people dying and the person who hadn't been vaccinated and carried it to that other person, and the guilt they experience is pretty horrific. So I think we have to think not only about our own vulnerability to the disease, but the role we play in this sort of societal spread. And the risk that we're trying to reduce is not just our own personal risk, but the risk to all those around us who are more vulnerable and who have done everything they can to protect themselves. But it is true, even with a vaccine, of course you're protected and of course you're less likely to get very ill, but there is still a chance. And as somebody, you know, myself, who's not in a high risk you know, age group, and I, you know, don't have a lot of those pre-existing conditions, I got that vaccine as soon as I could because I don't want, you know, my children or my children's teachers or my parents or other vulnerable people I know, I don't want to have any role in exposing people to risk.
We're talking about how to coexist with COVID-19 and the risks we're willing to live with as the virus continues to mutate. Julie Downs is our guest, Associate Professor of Psychology and Decision Science and Director of the Center for Risk Perception and Communication at Carnegie Mellon University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you assess risk with the changing landscape of COVID and the new variants as they come along? What leads you to make a decision to start or restart a particular precaution or stop taking it based on what you're seeing out there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about how to deal with COVID-19 in the long run and the risks we're willing to accept as the pandemic wears on. Julie Downs is our guest, Associate Professor of Psychology and Decision Science at Carnegie Mellon University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you assess different risks? Who do you look to for information about what is and isn't risky during COVID-19, the Delta variant, new hotspots coming out? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Mary is with us in Greendale. Mary, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to call. On this weekend, we are planning on moving to Portugal. And
wow.
I think it's a very interesting thing. We spent 20 days in July in Portugal and saw a completely different way of handling COVID. Everybody wore a mask everywhere. There was no question. Nobody complained. Everybody was in it to keep each other safe. When you are on mass transit, everybody had it on. It wasn't even a concern. The 3 feet, eating outside, and people from the government would actually come around and check on the tables and just make sure that you were vaccinated and, you know, a gentle reminder. And I just feel like if we would do something like that. The other thing is we got all these vaccines, the first out of all the other countries, and everybody, you know, went in, got their vaccines, and then it kind of stalled at around, what, 40, 49%? They're already in Portugal at 70%. There are zero cases of deaths on kids from COVID. I mean, it's just everybody, it's slow and steady. You know, if everybody would just hang in there. And I'm really glad to see what we're seeing, because moving there, it just is such a relief. I don't know where it's going to go from here.
Mary, I want to ask, I mean, I could see some upsides to Portugal anyway, but was this the safety here and the behaviors you saw there, was this a big factor in luring you to move over there?
Absolutely.
Mary?
Absolutely, because...
Mary, thanks a lot for sharing that. Julie, Mary and her family made a big decision in their risk assessment here. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to hear Mary talk about this and her perception of the risk and the risk mitigation strategies. You know, what are we doing to reduce the risk? We're living in this really risky environment. And the contrast between people, I think, making a risk assessment and wearing masks, and people may, you know, in Portugal more than here, people may be doing that because they have a stronger sense of the risk being high, but people are also likely doing that because there's more support and the sort of social norms, what's acceptable, what's normal, what's typical. In Portugal, sounds like there's just a lot more of that kind of psychological support for engaging in these very simple behaviors that we know really reduce the risk. Over here, you know, unfortunately, we've really seen things get politicized, that wearing a mask isn't such a simple, supported behavior. It's a little more contentious, and there are people who will get upset or will, you know, take it as some sort of political statement or personal attack or something like that, and that really undermines our ability to engage in these very straightforward, cheap, easy behaviors that are available to us, you know, to reduce the risk. And it's interesting to look at, you know, in my case, I have two children who are too young to get vaccinated yet. And, you know, I'm just waiting for them to get vaccinated. And they'll be going back to school in just a couple of days to a school where nobody else is vaccinated either. Obviously, the staff and the you know, faculty are all vaccinated, but there's going to be a lot of mask usage. And we've had these huge debates in this country about what we're going to do with these, you know, children who are too young to be vaccinated, and can we require masks? And unfortunately, we've gotten into this situation where it's not about reducing the risk anymore. It's about something much more complicated that really didn't have to be that way. And so I'm a little envious of Mary that Mary. She can go live in this place where she can take those kinds of precautions.
Thanks for sharing the story, Mary. Good luck with the move. Let's go now to Mark in southern Wisconsin. Mark, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
Which one?
I was just calling with a little bit of feedback on one of the earlier comments about, people that are vulnerable. I'm running an ambulance service and was involved with vaccine distribution in the area that I work in. Been vaccinated since December. A lot of people that have gotten COVID, and this is not only my own experience on our service, but the hospitals I work in as well, there's many people that have gotten it who refuse to get tested because of the politics around it. And so those numbers did not show up in the test results. And these are typically people that were refused to wear masks, you know, and I'm thinking back primarily last year. So we do have an issue with accuracy in the numbers, and a lot of those people were younger people. A lot of those people were healthy people, and, you know, they weren't supposed to get it because they didn't have heart conditions, they didn't have diabetes, they got it anyway, and they were embarrassed. And so they refused to get tested because they didn't want to acknowledge what they had. And the other issue, I think, going forward now is with those of us that are vaccinated, the fact that we can still carry it. And people are unvaccinated, they're not wearing masks, they're going out in public. And so tables have kind of been turned. And starting to see, at least in my area, animosity, unfortunately, because of the politics of that. And I'm just hoping that people will actually go out and get vaccinated, because the Delta variant is pretty scary. And we're starting to see those numbers come up again in our emergency rooms.
Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that story. I hope you don't see a big jump in work for COVID soon. Knock on wood. Julie, another frontline worker there, an EMT in this case. What do you think of what he had to share?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the sort of front line. He's observing these risk levels that I think a lot of the rest of us are sort of protected from. We don't see it day in, day out. And he also brings up a really important thing, which is that when something has become so politicized like this has, people maybe don't want to share when it's happening. And that really changes our perception of it happening. So if you lived in a community where people are really denying the risk of COVID, and those people who are getting it are not even sharing the information that they got it, it prevents the people around them from, like, yeah, maybe you're embarrassed to admit it, but the people around you, it prevents them from really seeing the reality and realizing that the risk of this is a lot higher than other things that we go to great lengths to reduce, you know, our risks of driving, our risks of, you know, contaminants in our environment, all these things that we really work hard to reduce the risk. The risk of COVID is many, many times that high. But if we don't see it, then we're not as motivated to protect ourselves.
Mark, thanks for that call. And Julie, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Julie Downs, Associate Professor of Psychology and Decision Science and Director of the Center for Risk Perception and Communication at Carnegie Mellon University. We talked to her today about how to coexist with COVID-19 as the virus and policies change over time. Coming up, a Wisconsin native known as the Motorcycling Yogi joins the show to talk about his love for biking and for yoga and how he brings the two of them together. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll visit an Oshkosh Museum exhibit that shows Wisconsin's ties to the wreck of the Titanic. Now, motorcycle riders in central Wisconsin got to take part in a unique experience over the weekend, a yoga class specifically for bikers. That class is the brainchild of our next guest, who says yoga has not only improved his experience riding, but also made it safer. Gregory Ormson is a Wisconsin native and a certified yoga instructor who's written nearly 100 articles about yoga. He's also a former Motorcycle Safety Foundation rider coach for the state of Hawaii. He's blended his love of yoga and motorcycles into a class for riders called Yoga and Leather. Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
Can you tell us about when you first discovered your love of motorcycles? We'll bring in the yoga in just a minute.
I guess that was when I was young, but I never had one because my parents said I was too reckless. And they were right. But I rode my brother's, put it in the ditch, and I said, I'll never ride again. And it was probably 25 or 26 years after that. I was in my mid-40s. I went into the dealership in Wausau, the Harley-Davidson dealership, picked out a beautiful white and red motorcycle, bought it, and I was hooked.
And when did yoga enter the picture for you?
Well, that's funny. It was not until a number of years after I first started motorcycling, and I had struggled with some back pain quite a bit, in fact. And, you know, as you're riding, your body takes a beating on the motorcycle on the bumpy highways. But I was in Hawaii, and I tried a yoga class, and I thought, wow, this is amazing how I feel. The owner said to me, Greg, why don't you take the 30-day challenge? And I said, okay. And he said, do as many as you can in 30 days. I did 24, and my back felt like it had not felt since I was 17, probably. And I thought, wow, okay, if this can help me, I'm pretty sure it can help other people too.
Now, I know Greg's stereotypes aren't always accurate, but my mental picture of yoga person and Harley person, there's not a lot of overlap there for me. Is it a hard sell sometimes bringing those two concepts together for people?
It is a hard sell, and it was a risk for the marketing coordinator at the Superstition Harley-Davidson in Arizona. to even let me offer this in the dealership. She said to me, in fact, you know, Greg, I'm going to catch a lot of guff for this, but I think we ought to do it. And we have a beautiful outdoor deck in Arizona looking at what's called the Superstition Mountains. And I did what I could. It took a long time, but I made it clear that the bikers could show up in their normal gear, boots, blue jeans, whatever it took, and they were comfortable in that environment. And while it took a while to encourage people to go, they took the risk. And before you knew it, I had quite a few showing up. And you're right, it's not really, the overlap is not clear. But the clear part of this overlap is that everybody in that class loves movement. You know, the bikers move forward, the ballet people move upward, but the judo people move downward. Yoga moves inward, and it also goes in each of those other directions. And so with the moving and the grounding in the dealership, they felt pretty comfortable. And somehow, we've been able to bridge those gaps that you so clearly point to.
Talking to Greg Ormson. He teaches yoga classes for bikers. He's known as the Motorcycling Yogi G. He is from Wausau. That's where he got his Harley, as you heard. Just taught a class in Marathon County, bringing together motorcycles and yoga. I've read, Greg, that you say that your yoga experience makes your motorcycle experience safer. How so?
Once when I was motorcycling in Hawaii, and this was during the time I was learning to become a motorcycle rider coach, and I was practicing figure eights on the riding range, and I was teaching a number of young people to ride this figure eight, which is a double U-turn in a small box. And I noticed them holding their breath and tightening up as they attempted this ride. And I thought, that's the opposite of relaxing. And then at the same time, I was taking the yoga and learning that our performance improves when we're relaxed in the midst of stress. That's the entire therapeutic in a nutshell right there. Be at ease in the midst of stress. And I started down this small, narrow turn with lava rocks on both sides. School was lighting out, mangoes in the street. There was a goat in the ditch. And I did a U-turn and pulled it off with kids running around, people opening and slamming doors on a narrow road in Hawaii at a dead end. And I thought, how come that was so simple and I felt so at ease? And it suddenly dawned on me, I've been practicing being at ease in the midst of stress in yoga. I thought it was a simple thing for me. And many riders even avoid U-turns because they're hard to do on a big motorcycle. And I thought, I've got to give this to other people. So I started incorporating more and more breath understanding as I taught motorcycle riders. And that has morphed into this program now that I've done in a number of places.
For people who have taken your yoga and leather classes, what kind of feedback do you get? What do you hear back from your students?
Well, they say things like, it has just made me sad that I didn't do this a long time ago. And they would say, we had these big old careers when we were young and we burned ourselves out, and now we need this more than ever. And one person actually said to me, I felt like I had an out-of-body experience. And that really struck me because in reality, what I think happened is that he was an elderly gentleman. He probably stopped exercising and stretching and doing the kind of things we were doing in the class, you know, decades earlier. And when he said it felt like an out-of-body experience, what he really felt, I think, was an in-body experience, what yogis call the embodiment of the asana or the putting of the movements into the body. But because he had been out of the body for so long, getting back into the body felt like an out-of-body experience. You know what I mean? But it was really the reverse.
Now, you are a writer as well, and you're a Wisconsin guy. You've been all over the country, all over the world, but you still write about your experience as a Midwesterner. What's it like when you get to come back and teach a class in Marathon County?
Oh, it's wonderful. I always say that my trek's north, and I usually make them in the spring when the loons return so I can be up there and hear them as well. But this year it was a little later due to a number of things. But I always say it's going back up to the trees. Because, man, I love the desert. I love the desert of Arizona. But back up in the trees is really, I think, at the core of my personality. And it's great to be back and in the blue waters and the green trees. And I'm happy with it. My family's here. My grandchild is here. It's home still.
And Greg, as we wrap up, can you make a pitch to somebody listening, biker or not, who yoga isn't even on their radar? How would you make the case that they might want to give it a shot?
Well, no matter what we are doing in life, to perform at our highest levels, and that means just living life too, we need to be at ease. I mean, why is it that, I would ask him to think of this, why is it that all the most valuable players in nearly every single sport point to yoga as a key aspect of their training regimen? Most notably, and most Wisconsinites will hear this pretty well, remember Aaron Rodgers? Mm-hmm. He does yoga. Remember when he said to you all, after the Packers were losing and had a bad start to the season, remember what they said to you all?
Oh, yeah.
R-E-L-A-X. And they went on an 8-game win streak. So to be at ease in the midst of stress will improve life performance in everything. That's why it might be worth taking a try.
Greg, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you, Rob. It's always good, and I appreciate the time and the listening audience, and give it a try, folks.
That's Gregory Ormson, also known as the Motorcycling Yogi G. He was with us to talk about the yoga classes he teaches for bikers called Yoga and Leather. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about a unique Madison artist.
For many of us, pets are part of our families. And what we keep to remember our pets who have passed away can take many forms. It can be a dog's old collar, or maybe a cat's favorite toy. Or in some cases, it may be a part of the pet itself, a one-of-a-kind piece of art or jewelry created by a very specialized blacksmith and artist named Lisa Lauren. WPR's Stephen Potter introduces us to this artist's work. A note of warning, the following story discusses animal processing.
Hi.
On the east side of Madison, Lisa Lauren shows me around her home and workshop.
Welcome to my house.
As she works, she explains what she does and why.
I have a business called Kettle Black Silver, and I process animals through that business in a variety of ways, as well as silversmith.
Aside from the occasional hunting trophy, most of the animal processing she does is of a pet that's passed away. In those cases, the owner wants to keep some part of their pet as a remembrance.
I think it's the same sort of emotion that someone would experience when they have an urn of a loved one given to them from a funeral home. You know, it's a very emotional, happy but grieving, bittersweet kind of reaction that most people have. I've done bone altars before. I've done wind chimes made out of bones. I've done sort of just like wall hangings with bones.
To clean up and carve some of the bones she processes, Lauren uses a blowtorch, a jewelry saw, and a rotary tool.
And it sounds like this. Usually when someone pays for me to do this, they have an idea of what they want done. So sometimes they just want all of the bones and they want them cleaned and they just want me to give them the bones cleaned. Sometimes they only want the skull. Sometimes people do want like a foot. I've made like feet keychains I've done a few times, like a rabbit foot keychain, but like a cat foot keychain.
As with all custom made art, the pieces she makes are similar yet unique.
So I'm a silversmith by trade. Under the business Kettle Black Silver, I do a lot of other animal-related work with that. So most common thing that I get paid for is making a ring with someone's, or a necklace with someone's animal hair in it, or ashes. So I'll make like memorial jewelry like that. I really like the art of it, and I really do like being able to have an alternative way for people to commemorate their animals.
Lauren also makes art and jewelry from wild animals that have died outdoors. In doing that, she makes an important distinction.
So I find things myself. Everything that I sell has been things that I have found personally out hiking. I'm outside a lot, like I said, and I've collected things throughout my whole life. It's extremely important for me to be telling my customers that everything I find has not been killed for the purpose of its art.
Lauren says people like animal bone art for a number of reasons. One of her most popular pieces is a ring with a coyote tooth in the place where a gemstone would be.
I think it's just part of a certain style that people really like. I think people like the way it looks, and I think it's something that's kind of unique and different. You really can't mass produce it.
Lauren understands that the act of animal processing, which involves removing meat and skin from bone, isn't for everyone.
And I get how it's taboo, and I still even see it as taboo in a little bit of a way, but I try to remember that we do this as a process to feed our bodies, and this is really the same process. If you kind of try to think about it in that way, it becomes a little bit less taboo.
Stephen Potter is a producer for the Ideas Network. He talked with Lisa Laurent of Kettle Black Silver. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, we'll hear from the curator of an Oshkosh exhibit showcasing the lives of some of the 50 people aboard the Titanic who had connections to Wisconsin. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Jen White's monthly hit list is back. Summer movie season promised a lot. Did it deliver? With the release of Black Widow, In the Heights, and The Suicide Squad, theaters lured some people back, but most Americans still stayed at home and streamed. Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, 109 years ago, the White Star liner RMS Titanic sunk after striking an iceberg, leading to the death of more than 1,500 passengers and crew members. Wisconsin Museum is paying respects to some of the 50 passengers on board who had Wisconsin ties with their current exhibit called Titanic, The Wisconsin Connection, on view now through October 13th. Deb Daubert is curator of exhibitions at the Oshkosh Public Museum. Deb, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Rob. I appreciate you covering us.
What was the inspiration for this Titanic exhibit?
Well, it went way back to 2006 when the museum had the larger regular boxed Titanic artifact exhibition. And to go along with that, I was just curious to find out how many links to Wisconsin I could find, and found quite a few. And later on, I was working with them to see what kind of smaller exhibit we could come up with. And they loved my research, so they thought they could do something with that. And so we started linking up not only just passengers, but how life in Wisconsin was so much like the life of the people that were on the Titanic, from immigration to boat building to electricity and on and on. And that is what you'll be seeing here, is all those different links to Wisconsin and some amazing artifacts.
I didn't know there were all those links. What kind of connections did people in the Titanic have to Wisconsin?
Well, they certainly had a lot of people immigrating over here, and so do we. They had a lot of people that, of course, built the boat, and we had boat building here in Oshkosh and Wisconsin because we're so near the lake, so that was a big industry here. We also had different social classes, and very clearly those were represented on the Titanic. And it's just so interesting to see that those people come alive again, and you can hear so much about them here.
And you mentioned some of the artifacts, Deb. What kind of things do we see when we check out the exhibit?
Okay, well, we have 136 items, which are more than what you see in the big exhibits all around. And some of them are things like a National Bank note from the Merrill, Wisconsin Bank. And we know one passenger on board, Daniel Coxon, was from Merrill. So that gives me goosebumps just thinking about that he might have had that. But there's also some books, and there's clothing, and there's tools that people used. So we have every class represented, along with some of the workers' tools. So you can see exactly how life more or less was frozen for those people at that time.
We're talking to Deb Daubert, curator of exhibitions at the Oshkosh Public Museum, looking at their exhibit now, Titanic, The Wisconsin Connection. Deb, what Could you tell us a little bit about the research that went into tracing these connections, especially, you know, the potential immigrants seeking to end up here in Wisconsin?
Well, there is a good online. You can find people that are just Titanic enthusiasts that way. But I went through a lot of different newspapers and just started looking for people they'd say were on the Titanic or were lost on the Titanic. And then I would follow that through Ancestry and some other forms to even link up with some of the descendants of those people. But it's interesting because one I missed, we just found out about, was for Fang Lang, who was one of the Chinese survivors. And as we're setting up this exhibit, his son called to tell about his father's story.
Wow.
And so we're so there's still research on all the people from Wisconsin linked to it.
That's great. Are you still, I mean, if people have a story like that in their family, are you still hoping to hear from people?
Oh, I'd love to hear from people because it's the Titanic doesn't get old, you know, it just, and as more and more people go through attics or find things or links from their letters and everything else in attics, more information is coming out. So this is just great. I'd love to hear it. They can get a hold of me through the museum.
And it seems like, Deb, you've really surrounded yourself with the life of Americans in 1912. Do we get a taste of that in the exhibit, just what it was like to exist in that time period?
You do, mainly because the museum building is the original home is from that era. Plus, we're showing a film that Universal Studios made of Oshkosh in 1912. And so you can see games people kids were playing. You can see workers coming out of the factories. And that all represents the same kind of people that were on the Titanic.
And then you've been deep into the newspaper archives, it sounds like. I mean, was the Titanic the dominant headline after that happened in, what, April of 1912?
It certainly was, and it's interesting because it wasn't the largest boat ever sank or the most people lost on a shipwreck, but for some reason, those stories, even the immigrant ones, were coming out. So for some reason, that hit a chord and still hits a chord today. I can't tell you how many 5- and 6-year-olds are coming in here with their grandparents because they are so enthused and about the story of the Titanic.
And Deb, how can people check out the exhibit at the Oshkosh Public Museum?
The best thing to do is to visit our website at oshkoshmuseum.org. And there you can get tickets online to make things go real smoothly. And it also tells you a little bit more about the exhibit. So oshkoshmuseum.org.
And it's been running for a month or two. Just briefly as we wrap up, Deb, what kind of response are you getting from people who visit?
Oh, it's just overwhelmed. Everybody has given nothing but praise about it. And the staff loves to talk to the visitors here to see, you know, their reactions and their enthusiasm. But yet at the same time, it is a memorial. And so we've had descendants come through.
Wow.
to talk about, you know, they heard stories about their great, great grandfather. And so I'm following up on those links too. So it's one of those that people are somber about, but yet at the same time, they're so excited about hearing about these people.
Deb, thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for having me. And I'd love to talk longer to anyone that wants to talk.
That's Deb Daubert, curator of exhibitions at the Oshkosh Public Museum. She joined us for a look at the current exhibit, Titanic, the Wisconsin Connection, running now through October 13th. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow at 8, it's this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. We'll be up on the roof. Get advice about basic roof maintenance and repair questions, plus a look at the options for solar panels. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we look at the history of customer service and find out why the pandemic has made angry customers even angrier. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.